Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We're learning a lot about the role that microbes play in the world, and especially for humans. And so I think people's ideas about, microbes are all bad are changing.
Rachel Dutton is a microbiologist who looks at cheese and its microbes. We'll find out about her work with chefs and how a certain type of bacteria from San Francisco is responsible for the world's sourdough breads. Lots of cheese in today's show. Chef Bob Adkins shows us just how easy it is to make your own cheese. Luke Runyon looks at the Future Farmers of America, or rather FFA, and why it's enjoying record enrollment. And our first barbecue story of the year. Yes, we visit a gas station that is famous for its barbecue. Food News kicks off the show. Here's Lou Ann Johnson.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is approaching foodborne illness in a different way, by mapping the genome of harmful bacteria. Harmful foodborne bacteria can result in public health crises and massive recalls, like the Listeria outbreak of 2011 that was traced to cantaloupe. Controlling contaminated food is currently handled through DNA testing, which can be time-consuming and at times imprecise. By using genome mapping, scientists can not only track outbreaks faster, but may be able to prevent infections before they start. As genome testing becomes more widespread in the medical field, the technology also becomes cheaper and easier for scientists to use. Congress recently awarded the CDC a $30 million grant to expand advanced molecular detection in hopes that future outbreaks will be traced more quickly and even be prevented. By linking DNA from those affected back to the food they consumed, genome mapping will allow scientists to more narrowly target the germs that cause food poison outbreaks. Previously, the CDC didn't have the capacity to deal with the massive amounts of data generated by genome mapping, but technology advances have made storing and using the data more manageable. Walmart estimates 91% of its shoppers would buy organic products, but they hold off because organics typically cost more. Now the retail giant is collaborating with Wild Oats to sell organic food at the same price as conventional items, at least 25% less than other organic brands it carries. Wild Oats was a chain of stores that Whole Foods acquired in 2007. Now the Wild Oats brand is relaunching as a line of organic foods. Walmart will be the only national retailer. Sales of organics in the U.S. are projected to increase 12% every year through 2020, totaling as much as $60 billion, and Walmart wants a piece of that pie. Grocery sales accounted for 55% of Walmart's nearly $275 billion in sales last year. Starting as early as this month, Wild Oats items will be sold in about 2,000 stores. And what if your cell phone could tell you how many calories are in that hamburger? The lab responsible for the technology behind Siri is working on an app for that. Take a picture of the food and get an estimated calorie count. One difficulty for developers is getting the image recognition technology to identify hidden ingredients. Keep an eye out for this app sometime next year. And keep an eye on our Twitter account for the latest food news and notes. Join the conversation at twitter.com/EarthEats.
All right, Lou Ann Johnson with Food Headlines. Thanks.
You got it.
The blue corduroy jacket worn by high school students in FFA, formerly the Future Farmers of America, is an icon of rural life. It is a nearly 100-year-old symbol of pride worn by high schoolers that signifies a background and desired future in agriculture. And as KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, even with fewer and fewer kids growing up on farms, a record number of kids are donning blue jackets this year.
18-year-old Reese Melton says when he grows up, he wants to raise cows.
So this is our school farm. And
Andy's getting plenty of hands-on education at the St. Vrain Valley School District's working farm in Longmont, Colorado. The city of 90,000 has deep agrarian roots tucked in between its sprawling suburban developments.
Going down Sunset Road in the middle of Longmont, you wouldn't think there's a livestock facility back behind here.
Melton is president of the district's FFA chapter. While he now spends part of his school day doing farm chores, he grew up in a nearby town, not on a farm. And that's the norm for the 60 other students in his chapter.
We're in an urban area, so most of our members do not grow up on property, though they still have that connection to agriculture.
The millennial generation is one step removed from the farm. That's why the school district is going to great lengths to make agriculture appeal to more students.
So this jacket is just from the 80s.
Lauren Hart is the district's FFA advisor and an agriculture instructor. In her 8 years of teaching, she's noticed a shift. A greater number of students are interested in
farm fresh foods, organic foods, natural cage-free, grass-fed, and all those trending topics in food right now.
In place of traditional conventional farming methods. And Hart says she can't just ignore what students want to learn about.
The interest and the ability both of students going into production agriculture is declining. It's just not something that a high school student either wants to or believes they're able to get into.
When she's planning a curriculum, Hart says she tries to reach further into areas you wouldn't typically associate with farming. Some classes touch on law, policy, entrepreneurship, and bookkeeping, all with an agricultural touch. And that's something that doesn't always sit well with some students' parents who hail from farm country.
Why aren't you doing XYZ? And when are you going to have my student on a tractor? Well, never, unfortunately.
The perception is that FFA is plows, cows, and sows.
National FFA Organization CEO Dwight Armstrong says programs like HEARTS are taking off, and the changing focus appears to be working. Nearly 580,000 students are enrolled in FFA this year, a record for the organization. And inner-city chapters in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York are some of the fastest-growing in the country.
Because now we talk about not vocational agriculture, but the science of agriculture and the science of food.
And in those topics, Armstrong says teachers can begin to point students on more stable career paths, something that couldn't be said during the 1980s farm crisis. That's when enrollment numbers slumped, chapters closed, the name went from Future Farmers to FFA, and the group's new mantra became adapt or die.
There are success stories.
Mike Martin teaches ag education at Colorado State University.
And then there are maybe not so successful stories. And I don't want to call it failure, but it's sort of this struggle to adapt.
And they're pretty much close to ready.
Back at the school farm in Longmont, Reese Melton and his classmate Samuel Johnson are planning the next coop for a flock of fast-growing chickens. Both have the iconic FFA blue corduroy jackets hanging in their closets at home, which, at first, Melton says he griped about wearing.
It's definitely not the most stylish outfit, but it's something that's more relative to tradition.
And it's kind of neat that the jacket didn't change throughout the years. It's always been blue corduroy, same emblem and everything.
A static symbol of tradition in an otherwise dynamic and always changing organization. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. A basic cheese-making demonstration with Chef Bob Adkins coming up in about 15 minutes. We do have cheese on the brain today. Let's delve into the science behind the stuff. Dr. Rachel Dutton is a Bauer Fellow at Harvard University, where she studies cheese and its microbes. The New York Times has called her the go-to source for chefs and food artisans seeking to unravel the mysteries of microorganisms. She stopped by the Earth Eats studios earlier this month.
When I first think about cheese and their microbes, I go back to November 2013 when I read maybe the craziest article I've ever read, where a UCLA microbiologist made cheese from the microbes on human skin. Specifically, this was from Michael Pollan, who is a food writer and just a famous food activist. Gross factor aside, is this just a science party trick, or can we actually learn something from this?
So I know the scientist who did that, Christina Agabakis, and she is a synthetic biologist. And so it was part of an art and science project to sort of challenge the notion people have about microbes. We're learning a lot about the role that microbes play in the world and especially for humans. And so I think people's ideas about, microbes are all bad are changing. And I think this is sort of this project was an opportunity for her to kind of really bring that idea of microbes that you might normally associate as something bad to actually, you know, something more relatable. And so something we're finding in our research is that a lot of the microbes that are normally on cheese are actually closely related to the microbes from the human body. So those cheeses that smell like stinky feet, the bacteria that give them those smells are actually related to the bacteria that grow in our skin and cause us to have stinky feet. So it's actually not that much of a jump to think that we could actually just make cheese from skin microbes themselves.
Okay, let's go back to the gross factor. Would you try cheese made from human microbes?
May not. but I think we don't actually know where a lot of the microbes are coming from on some of the cheeses we eat. So they're probably coming from the skin of the animals, for some of them at least. So it's, you know, it's not actually that different.
Just a new way to think about food, maybe.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your work with chefs. You've worked with David Chang and other chefs that are perhaps household names for some people. What questions are they asking you? What information do they want from a scientist?
Yeah, so I think chefs are getting more and more interested in fermentation, in curing their own meats and making their own cheese, pickling. And all of those things are, I think, interesting to chefs because of the flavors that you create during these processes. And they want to be able to understand how these fermentations work so that they can control them better in their environment or maybe come up with creative alternatives to the traditional foods. So all of these fermentations involve communities of microorganisms. And so being a food microbiology lab, we are perfectly suited to trying to think about the science behind these foods and try and help them come up with new ideas. And then I think in general, people are getting more and more interested in how to do things themselves. So this sort of DIY kind of movement in every area is also applying to fermentation. So people, you know, not necessarily restaurant chefs, but people at home are making their own beer, making their own cheese, making kombucha. We actually have a kombucha vat going in our lab just for our own consumption.
Nice.
So I think just people are becoming more interested in where their food comes from. And for fermented foods, a lot of that has to do with the actual microbes that are fermenting the food. So it's a really interesting time in food, and it's an amazing time to be a food microbiologist.
Before we get too far away, what is kombucha for people who have never had it?
Yeah, so kombucha is an ancient fermented tea. So you brew black or green tea, and you add a little bit of sugar or honey, and it's this really crazy looking, it's called a SCOBY, which is a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. And it forms this mat that floats on the surface of your jar of tea. And the yeast in this SCOBY ferment the sugar to ethanol and CO2, so gas, so it's fizzy. And then the bacteria that are part of this symbiosis convert that ethanol to acetic acid, which is vinegar. So you end up getting this fizzy, tart, tea-flavored drink, which I think for a lot of people is an acquired taste. When I first tried it, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
But now I'm sort of addicted to it.
And it is not the prettiest looking drink.
No, it's not. It has these sort of like gooey kind of strands from the culture.
Yeah.
And the SCOBY itself is this incredibly interesting microbial mass. We've done some microscopy of it in the lab, and it's really interesting. And it actually produces cellulose as part of its structure. So it's just the whole world of food microbiology is completely fascinating.
Yeah. Terroir, this concept of the taste of a certain place. Terroir is a food buzzword. Talk about this idea of microbial terroir and what chefs are doing with that.
Yeah, so the idea is that because the flavor from a lot of these fermented foods, now whether that is bread or wine or cheese or, you know, your kimchi or whatever, because the flavor is coming from the microbes, if the microbes are only found in certain places, does that mean that if you make, let's say, cheese in two different places, could you potentially get different flavors based on which microbes you happen to have around? This is something that's been looked into to some extent with things like sourdough cultures and a little bit more recently in wine. We're starting to look at some of these ideas in cheese, but it's not really clear to me just yet whether it's something that we have an answer for. I don't think I'm willing to say whether absolutely yes, microbial terroir exists or not.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, yes. Okay.
You mentioned sourdough. I had a bread baker mention this thing to me that blew my mind. Sourdough starters all sort of come from this one area in San Francisco. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So sourdough involves the making bread with the yeast that you would normally make it with, but it also has these bacteria called lactic acid bacteria, and they are what produce the sour flavor. And so when these bacteria were first characterized, they were characterized in the sourdoughs of San Francisco, which is known for its sourdough bread. And it's a tradition, you know, it's been a tradition for over 100 years. So when they characterized the bacteria, they identified these lactic acid bacteria that were involved in making the sourness, and they named it Lactobacillus sanfranciscensis, after San Francisco.
There we go.
And so I think initially people thought, okay, well, this idea of microbial terroir, Lactobacillus sanfranciscensis, is only going to be found in San Francisco because, you know, you can only make that kind of sourdough bread. But then people started looking in Italy and other places where sourdough bread is traditionally made, and they found Lactobacillus sanfranciscensis everywhere. So it's interesting because these microbes might be very widespread in terms of what specific types they are, but they might still have unique properties based on where they come from.
Do we know how microbes travel from San Francisco to Spain, for instance?
No.
No idea?
No. No. And so that's a sort of a interesting area of study in the field of microbiology right now, is this idea of biogeography, of, you know, where microbes live and how they might travel from place to place.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Dr. Rachel Dutton of Harvard spoke at Indiana University recently. Her topic was Food for Thought, Cheese as a Model Microbial Ecosystem. More with Dutton next week, and how microbes in the cheese we eat affect the microbes we already have living in our guts. Don't miss a single episode of Earth Eats. Subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes. Coming up, barbecue.
Around here, people like Chicago-style ribs.
Explain that to me.
Fall off the bone.
Which I just learned today is overcooked.
It's way overcooked, and that's why all the restaurants do it, the big chains, because you can't mess them up.
I talk barbecue with Chris Smith of Shortstop Food Mart. His pop-up restaurant sets up shop once a week in a gas station parking lot, but don't be fooled by the quirky location. This place knows barbecue. Then it's back to cheese with Chef Bob Adkins. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-202-0055. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Chris Smith, the owner-operator of Shortstop Food Mart and Gas Station, doesn't need much of an excuse to get his barbecue train going.
Because it's Thursday. And in Bloomington, Indiana, Thursday is Barbecue Thursday. Everybody in town knows that.
Parking at the Shortstop comes at a premium on Thursdays. The road it's on isn't a main thoroughfare, which is a good thing, because traffic is backed up for a block in both directions. The food table has a line of people that stretches past the gas pumps, and it's not even dinner time yet. They serve up Texas-style brisket, Carolina-style pork, and Chicago-style ribs every Thursday throughout the summer, 10:30 to 6. This is a special Thursday because Smith is sharing his parking lot with award-winning barbecuer and educator Chris Marks.
Can I get a pulled pork sandwich, please?
Yeah. We went to his barbecue boot camp down in Sellersburg, Indiana.
No bun.
Sandwich, no bun. We fell in love with what he did because it's very technical, very involved process, great knowledge base. And in the process, we learned we needed a new grill. So we bought a grill from him, got to know the guy, and said, hey, let's have some fun.
So would you like a rib? Would you like... We got alligator.
Let's try a rib and some alligator.
Okay. Chris Marks, and I am a champion barbecuer. I travel the country barbecuing.
Marks has the resume to back it up. He's won American Royal Barbecue Contest Grand Championships 8 times, along with 45 other regional contests throughout the U.S.
Oh, there's a good rib. Yes, there's a good rib.
So what's your secret?
Low and slow. Usually I can do those ribs you're having right there in about 4 hours. So it's a different type cooking, but you look at the different flavors that you get with it.
So you're not using a gas grill?
Oh, my. I just had a heart palpitation.
Sacrilegious?
Sacrilegious. No, I'm not. Well, you can get so much more flavor with charcoal and wood. Gas is really for ease. You know, it's about, I just want to turn it on and basically turn, we call it turn and burn.
Marks teaches barbecue boot camps all over the country. Shortstop's barbecue cook Garrick Devane attended a class last year in Sellersburg, Indiana, along with food writer Lynn Schwartzberg. They came back from the class wanting to change things up for the barbecue offered in Bloomington. Smith agreed.
We really want to do a Kansas City-style rib. We're going to transition to that somewhat. The problem is it's regional. You've got to be careful your regions. Around here, people like Chicago-style ribs.
Explain that to me.
Fall off the bone.
Which I just learned today is overcooked.
It's way overcooked, and that's why all the restaurants do it, the big chains, because you can't mess them up. You season them right, put the right sauce on them, you cannot mess them up. To do a real competition-style or Kansas City-style rib is very difficult. And timing is everything. And then the question is, can you deliver those all day?
Let me see if I can find a rib to show you correctly. Look there, got one right on top. You can see how this rib looks. What we want it to do is when we bite that rib, we want to do it gently to tug it. See how it comes off the bone right there?
I see clean bone.
That's exactly what we're looking for. It's not falling off the bone. That's overcooked. But look at this rib. It's nice. It's moist. You will not get that with falling off the bone. So you take another bite, and you see how that bone comes clean. That's a correctly cooked rib right there. That was a good rib, by the way, seriously.
In addition to the ribs, Marks and Smith are cooking up scotch eggs, fatties, shrimp, salmon, sausage links, and lamb chops. Smith's pick for the best item on the menu today?
Should have gotten the brisket, but it's gone.
Pictures of the barbecue train and tips for making your own barbecue deliciousness, eartheats.org. In the kitchen with Chef Bob Adkins, he says making your own cheeses helps personalize a meal. It's also a money saver, and you can control the ingredients. No mystery preservatives, please, and thank you. Now, don't be daunted by this. These are recipes for really basic cheeses, queso fresco, ricotta, and mascarpone. Yes, he's making all three at the same time, and so can you. Preparation today starts with the queso fresco.
So one of the easiest cheeses that one can make in-house is an ancient style of taking just regular milk on a medium heat. I'm going to stir in 6 tablespoons of white vinegar. So the vinegar is going to act as the curdling agent. I'm going to bring that up to about 190 to 200 degrees. But what it's going to do is that heat is going to activate the vinegar. The vinegar is going to separate the milk solids, the protein, the milk proteins from the liquid. While that's coming up, we can move on to another type of fairly simple cheese, a ricotta. This is the same idea as the queso fresco, but with the addition of heavy whipping cream, which has some emulsifiers in it. For the ricotta, I'm going to take 4 cups of milk. To the milk, I'm going to add 2 cups of cream, 2 teaspoons of salt. I'm going to bring this up to one boil.
So we're starting to chunk a little bit over here in the queso fresco. What's our temperature?
Our temperature now, we're reading at right around 100 degrees. The ricotta is starting to simmer a little bit on the side. As those are coming together, we can actually do another preparation.
So we got 3 cheeses on the stove now.
We're gonna have three different types of cheese. Another very simple at-home thing to do: mascarpone cheese or mascarpone. Hopefully, nobody's getting too confused here, going back and forth from all these different terms. But this is really kind of easy to do all of these. You could do them all at once and just really have a dairied out party. I'm gonna add to this 2 tablespoons of lemon juice. After you let this relax for 10-15 minutes, you could strain it through a coffee filter, and what little whey is left would strain through that, and you would end up with a very, very thick mascarpone. In the meantime, we can check the temperature of our queso fresco again while keeping an eye on our mascarpone over here on this other burner. Gonna level out right around 170, so maybe 5 more minutes on the heat. The queso fresco should be at the appropriate temperature. Has really started to congeal, and it's those curds that you want. In the meantime, we can move back over to our mascarpone. You can see that it's really starting to thicken up.
And it's got a little bit of a yellow tinge to it.
It does, and that's probably from the lemon juice.
Meanwhile, the
ricotta does look great, and as it's sat and it's draining through there, I'm going to grab a spoon, and you can see this is looking more and more like ricotta that you would find at a store.
After this, you strain it through some cheesecloth, and then you're done. I know, it sounds very confusing. Even Bob Atkins had a hard time keeping it all straight, and hey, he's the pro. Luckily for us, we have all 3 of these basic cheese recipes on our website, EarthEats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Bob Atkins, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Rachel Dutton, Lauren Glapa, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Chris Marks, Betsy Shepard, Chris Smith, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. One more thing, not to forsake our non-dairy friends this week, we do have recipes for vegan cheese at EarthEats.org. Thanks for listening, guys. I'm Annie Corrigan.